Podcast listeners, you've listened to the podcast. Now you want the chance to come on the program yourself. So here it is. Do you remember those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would pick where to go next and follow that story? Well, help us flesh out the VitBuckle Society complication session at the annual meeting in March 2020 by submitting your surgical videos of your complications in vitreoretinal surgery. These videos can be narrated or anonymous with the description to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. We all learn more from reviewing our mistakes as groups and with our colleagues, so this is a great learning opportunity. And two big things, the top five entries will be shown during the meeting and discussed by a panel discussion, but more importantly, if you're one of the top five entries, we'll invite you to come on the podcast for a one-on-one interview to discuss the case and learning points. The winning entry out of the five will then win a special VitBuckle Society buckle, so send your entries to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, we have a slight switch of gears as I sit down with one of my colleagues in the oculoplastics department here at Bascom Palmer Institute, Dr. Chris Alabiad. And we're here not to discuss oculoplastics, but to discuss medical education. We discuss his take on medical education, and we talk a little bit about the residency application process as well, and how we see education evolving as we move forward in the future. Remember that this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes may qualify for CME credits via the American Academy of Ophthalmology. To claim your credit, simply click on the link in the episode description. Remember that also a list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Joining me today will be Dr. Chris Alabiad. He is the Associate Program Director at the Bascom Palmer Institute, where he's also an Associate Professor of Clinical Ophthalmology in the Department of Oculoplastics. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
So, Chris, again, giving listeners some background, very often we have retinal surgeons. I've done a couple of these sit-downs. I had Dr. Guillermo Mesqua, I had Sandra DeBovey, Nell Grigori. I like doing the sit-down interviews. They're more fun. So let's talk a little bit about your background first. So give people some you grew up in South Florida.
I'm a South Florida native, born and raised, and even stayed here for college and medical school, just
University
like you
Miami.
Did.
Both of us are Canes, orange yep. and green. It's not much to be proud of recently with our sports teams, but that's okay. And then you decided to do ophthalmology. So first of all, why did you decide to do ophthalmology?
You know, I made the decision to go into ophthalmology fairly late in the game. I was a fourth-year medical student here towards the end of my third year, actually, and I started shadowing in the clinics, and I started working with a few of the cornea faculty, Carol Karp and Richard Forster, and I just really enjoyed the relationships they developed with their patients. I really enjoyed the mixture that they had with clinic and surgical practices, and I found that my best suits were lying somewhere between surgery and internal medicine. And so it was along those lines that I felt ophthalmology was a good fit for me. And after doing a few rotations, I was committed to it and ended up applying for ophthalmology residency.
So most people go through a traditional path. They apply for residency, they go to residency, and then they move on with their career. Some people have to not match and then go on. We had Tom Gardner, for example, who was very open about how he didn't match years ago in ophthalmology. But yours is much more unusual, I think, right? So you apply for ophthalmology residency. You match. You decide to do your internship at the House of God, Harvard, internal medicine year. And then you stayed. So tell me, first of all, why did you decide? So nowadays we have applicants who are deciding they want to do transitional years, they want internal medicine or surgery. How did you first decide to do an internal medicine year, despite the fact you're going to ophthalmology? And then what motivated you to stay?
I think there is always a cohort of applicants who feel tied to medicine and enjoy it. And I pursued a preliminary medicine internship for the reasons that I just stated. And I feel that having a really solid background in internal medicine is quite critical to being a successful ophthalmologist, and I felt like I was able to recognize that early on in my training. And as a result, I wanted to make sure that I gave myself the best opportunity to get exposures to some of the more difficult and critical medicine problems that people can be facing. And a lot of our ophthalmology patients actually have a fair amount of challenging medicine problems that actually interfere with their ophthalmic disease as well. So the ophthalmic manifestations of systemic diseases were always a source of interest for me, and it was along those lines that I chose the prelim internal medicine at a fairly intense internship.
Right. But then you stay.
So during
That's a big decision.
It is a very big decision, and you know, there are a lot of reasons why someone will choose to stay. My prelim program actually took pride in converting a lot of people in dermatology, radiology, and ophthalmology to actually drop out of their categorical position and go into the categorical medicine track. And so my program director actually on interview day made me aware of that, because I specifically asked what happens when people decide to change their mind, and they were very open about converting people. So during my internship, it was probably 3 months in, I felt that my exposures to medicine were just so profound and intense and amazing, and the mentorship that I had from my third-year residents was equally outstanding, and their ability to manage some of the most complex patients and take them from the brink of death was actually just mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, you know, you develop a friend circle, you develop a community, you start developing as a physician the way you think about a patient, the way you kind of systematically get through and identify problems and identify unifying diagnosis. And then you see the competence of someone at the end of the road in the form of a third-year resident, and you say to yourself, wow, I want to be that.
That's what I want to be. So you make that decision. And that's a binary decision, right? So for, you know, the listeners, there's a lot of residents or fellows, sometimes medical students listening. It's not, maybe in a special circumstance, you speak to your ophthalmology program and they find it a way. But remember, these spots are given out on an annual basis, right? So it's not like a program can generally hold a spot for you if you finish. And so you're basically giving up ophthalmology at this point, at least your spot.
I did consider all of those things, and I actually had to have that conversation with my program director, and actually was informed that this decision would really lead to a situation in which I would never have a chance to do ophthalmology again. And I understood that. The ophthalmology community is very small, and word does get out that someone had a chance to do ophthalmology and gave it up.
Most of the small medical subspecialties, for better or for worse, they really want 150% dedication throughout your whole life sometimes. Not realistic sometimes, but that's almost it. We look, and we'll talk about applications a little later in interviewing and mentorship, but like it's because I think we search for these really small differences between really qualified people that's something that probably honestly they felt that was going to be a deterrent if you ever wanted to get back in. You do your internal medicine residency, and then what decisions are you facing at that point?
So then as you're doing internal medicine residency, you're pushed to identify what specialty in internal medicine you want to pursue. Or if you want to just become a generalist, a hospitalist, etc. And I actually found myself really drawn to the heart. So I started pursuing research in electrophysiology and heart failure and found some amazing mentors over there. And it was through that process that I also just pursued a cardiology fellowship. So I ended up applying to a number of amazing cardiology fellowships, went on all my interviews, and was in the process of formulating a rank list together with regards to deciding where I wanted to spend the next 3 or 4 years.
Then what happens next?
It was at that point I was actually attempting to do a second look at a cardiology program in San Francisco. And at that point I check my cell phone and I see that there's a voicemail from Miami. So I call my voicemail, and it's a message from the program director asking me to give them a call back. So Ophthalmology program director, yeah, in Miami, which was my home school, which, by the way, I had amazing relations with, never really had any negative, you know, interactions after I had left South Florida. And when I called back, I was informed that there was an ophthalmology position that was vacant, and they were trying to gauge my interest in pursuing ophthalmology residency.
Super unusual.
Extremely unusual.
Maybe the only time, perhaps, in this program's history, possibly, at least in recent memory, that a PGY2 spot has opened like that.
Correct. And it was actually the month of May that this phone call happened, and in the PGY2 year, it was to start towards the end of June, early July. So
short time.
Short time
maybe
frame.
And they love you, but maybe that's also why they're reaching out. They're probably scrambling. They have a short list,
Someone has to finish their internship. And so I was finishing my third year of medicine residency at that point in time. And I said to myself, I was in a little bit of shock and disbelief, but of course it's also very exciting. And I remember exactly where I was. I was in the Presidio in San Francisco when I had this phone call with Steve Getty, the program director then, and actually continues to be the program director now. And he said, you know, can you give me a decision in the next 24 hours? And so here
probably
I am.
Probably smart. Probably smart not to give you too much time to think about it. Sure. Right? And he probably needed it fast.
He needed it fast.
He needed someone right away.
And maybe it's better to do a gut check and make that decision quickly, like you suggested.
What's your first instinct?
My first instinct was take it.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I left the phone call with him saying it's a tentative yes. So I even made the decision on the phone at that moment, and I told him I would call him the next day.
Did you finish your second look?
I did not finish my second look.
So you do this. So you make the decision, and maybe your initial answer is tentative yes, but then you make a yes, right? And now you're going to a great residency program, right? But it's different. You've already gone through training. So I always wonder, you know, it's always interesting to see people already. Residency is difficult, right? Residency is rewarding. You gain a lot. But there are a lot of things you do in residency where you sacrifice and you give up things. And you're giving up in the hope of a better tomorrow. You're moving up that totem pole. And now you're going right back down the totem pole. And I think it takes a special sort of personality. We've seen a couple people, not just you, who have done that, who have done multiple residencies. But it's a challenge, you know? And I talked to Dr. DeBovian about this when he did two residencies, the path residency and ophthal residency. Talk about that transition. Like, did you have any regrets? You're in the middle of first year. I'm sure it's difficult. Do you ever feel like, man, you know, I could be a cardiologist right now, or a cardiology fellow at least, and here I am, you know, back learning a whole new language and kind of starting from scratch?
You know, it's interesting you say that. I think it's all about perspective and how you approach things. And so when I approached the whole ophthalmology residency situation, I almost felt like I wasn't worthy of being where I was amongst a cohort of really accomplished co-residents. And so it was with that type of approach that I felt that I was, you know, maybe a little bit coming from the needing to prove myself side, as opposed to, oh, I've done all of this. Mm-hmm. I am such a hotshot. But I also recognize that, you know, we're all life learners. And no matter where you are, you're always going to be a student. There's always going to be a need to be respectful and appropriate and identify the strata that exist within the medical environment. And so I don't think that I ever really felt that type of strain or concern or need to be, you know, the person who was better than anyone else.
So the common question I ask people when they come on the podcast, why did you choose to get to retina? Because most of the people come on the podcast are retina specialists, a retina podcast. You didn't do retina. And if I had told somebody, I have this ophthalmologist who did internal medicine, and then ophthalmology, and then they did the fellowship, retina may not be number one, but it'd be up there in terms of and all the connections to general internal medicine. So why did you decide not to do internal medicine? And in a positive note, why did you decide to do oculoplastics?
So, you know, that's a really big question that I struggled with throughout my residency. As a matter of fact, when I came to this residency program here in Miami, I think that one of the things that followed with me was my love for internal medicine. Mm-hmm. And as a result, my colleagues felt that I would be a natural fit for uveitis. And so I felt very inclined to pursue a degree in vitreoretinal surgery and uveitis. And I thought that perhaps I'd be able to make a big impact in the field by having such a unique background and being able to manage some complicated patients. It requires as much, if not more, detail-oriented approach to the patient care and management and diagnosis. And I felt that, however, in retina and uveitis, I wasn't as involved in the hospital system mm-hmm. as I would have otherwise been in as an internist, for example. And so I started to explore the oculoplastics pathway and started to recognize that the disease processes in oculoplastics actually have a similar carryover to the uveitis cohort of patients, but that your surgical practice also involves, you know, collaborating with a lot of other subspecialists. And so I felt really much more drawn to the pathologies mm-hmm. in oculoplastics, from the oncology that's involved to the autoimmune diseases that are involved to the infectious diseases that are involved, and the opportunities also to collaborate with a myriad of subspecialists throughout the hospital system.
So you do an oculoplastics fellowship, you end up staying here. You're a lifer, only besides that time in Boston. And then you stay on faculty. You and your co-fellow, Dr. Sarah Wester, stayed as faculty. And I remember this well because you guys were fellows when I was a medical student. So it's funny how this chain keeps going. 10 years ago, right? It's been a decade since then. It's been a long time. you look the same.
Thanks, Jay.
So now you have multiple hats, right? So you're an associate professor of clinical ophthalmology. You train oculoplastics fellows. You work with the residents as an oculoplastics attendings. You've been assistant dean of student affairs in the medical school. So you work with medical students. And then now you're associate program director of the residency program. And so you do multiple things. And we're going to talk about this. But let's talk about just in general the idea of working with medical students and medical education. And so how we talk about this on the podcast a lot. How medical education has evolved from now, from 10 years ago, and where is it going to go, and where should it go? Because the common things we hear are our new students have a little more ADD. They need things in a different format. You know, we're much more digital than we were before. Audio and video are going to be more important than ever. And education is going to be much more case-based. It should be much more proactive. This idea of the flipped classroom, which you can talk a little about, is becoming more prevalent. Where do you see education today compared to when you were in medical school or when you were at Brigham, you know, in Harvard? And where do you think it will be in 10 or 15 years when our students are teaching the next generation?
Sure. Well, you know, I think gone are the days of the didactic session where there's one professor in the front of the classroom and then an audience of 100 to 250 students where the information is just being thrown out and then you're expected to regurgitate it on mm-hmm. an exam. Now the days include a lot of integrated learning, incorporating concepts from different kind of subjects all into one type of lecture that's probably case-based and very interactive. And there's also a new introduction of technology, as you suggested, that really allows students to access a myriad of resources to prepare for these in-class sessions. And the concept of the flipped classroom comes up, and it's something that we've actually worked on here at the University of Miami in many classes, but specifically in the ophthalmology and the dermatology module. And the idea is that the students learn in a variety of ways. Some are really good at reading books, some are really good at listening to audio, and some are good at watching a video. And some people need a combination of the above. And so the objective is to offer students opportunities to learn in a way that is most conducive to learning for them. And what might work for you may not work for me, and vice versa. So having an opportunity to engage in content in a variety of ways is really kind of the direction that we are trying to support amongst our medical students. And I think that's a common theme among medical schools across the country. When it comes to where I see the future of medical education going, I think it's going to continue to include these types of approaches, but I think it's also going to try to maybe get students more involved clinically, involved with clinical content earlier as compared to a lot of the basic sciences that employed this 2-year plus 2-year model where they would spend 2 years in the classroom and then spend 2 years on the wards, and move towards a model in which the students engage in this basic science content, but for a shorter period of time, 12 to 18 months, which a lot of medical schools have already adapted, and then use the remainder of that time to develop other skills, whether it's research skills and study design, or whether it's clinical skills, or a combination of other interests that they may also concurrently have. Interest in business, interest in ethics, interest in social medicine, and other pathways. So I think that that's the direction we can expect the educational current to go.
Millennials take a lot of flack in the media, probably because most people writing are not millennials. We're both technically sort of millennials. I mean, we both slide into that umbrella, but there is a definition of the time it refers to, but I think there's a more holistic kind of global definition of what it means to be a millennial. And I think one of the counter arguments, but people, devil's advocate arguments, say is like, well, two arguments. One, I understand that student X works best this way because that works best for him. But it can be a fine line between doing that and the expectation of a student or a person that everything be always tailored to what they need, because that's not how education works in the real world necessarily. But the second thing, and I wonder about this, and we've talked a little bit about this, is our patient-doctor interactions are still very, quote-unquote, retro. We still, for the most part, meet in person. We still wear the white coat, though some choose not to. Whether you're in a bed in an ICU or you're in a clinic room examining a patient's eyes, there's a still kind of an old school kind of interaction, kind of, you can call it a song and dance, but there is a ritual to it that is there. And now you have a generation that their ways of interacting with the world and with their peers have changed. These are people who didn't grow up meeting their friends in person sometimes. They meet their friends on the internet. And these are people who experience the highs and lows of social media. They give compliments on the internet and they bully on the internet. All the same things that we went through in school when they were growing up. And now they're growing up and they're having to deal with patients in a more traditional manner because their patients are older and their patients, as they get older, we have an aging population, are alive and they're well and they're 70 and 80 and they didn't grow up like this. And we're switching your hats. You're assistant dean of student affairs. You interact with the medical students. You see, how do you balance those two things? You want to educate students the best way that they learn, because you can't keep teaching people the same way, because doesn't make sense. But how do you balance that with the fact that their doctor-patient interactions are not evolving necessarily at the same rate as their interactions with the rest of the world? Or evolving is the wrong word, because it says the one's better than the other, but they're not changing as rapidly.
I think that's a little bit more of a challenging question. I feel like our physician-patient interactions are evolving a little bit.
Right.
And some examples of that include our abilities to communicate through electronic charts, and be a little bit more on-demand available. And I think that caters a little bit to the newer generation of learner and physician who's really been engaged in social media in a similar way. And I also feel that people are communicating to their patients through text messages and say, hey, let me know if you can't make it. Send me a picture of what it looks like. And I know that there are a lot of medical legal concerns with that, but it does help facilitate a relationship between the patient and the physician in that you care and that you're willing to take the time even though they're not able to make it. So in those ways, I think that some of the traditional physician-patient interactions are slightly evolving. I think that the challenges that we have to face is try to meet halfway in the middle between the millennial and the traditional individual. And one of the things that I have learned as a student affairs dean is that you have to kind of understand what's acceptable in a relationship between a student and the educator or the patient and what's not. And I think that the students have been indoctrinated with the importance of wellness and taking time for self and trying to find the best ways to learn for them.
All important.
All very important, but sometimes at the expense of them not recognizing the importance of what's good for the whole team as opposed to what's good for just them.
Wellness is not an individual sport.
Correct.
Yeah.
And also, it's a little bit of a balance. So we in or the older generation maybe doesn't take care of themselves at all. They don't take time off to go vacation, to spend time with family, etc. But this newer generation is more focused on spending time at home, being closer to home, making decisions that involve them staying close to their comfort zone and social networks. And so there's a lot that we can learn, but there's also a fine line of what is acceptable and what is not, and mainly what puts a patient in danger is the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important for us to teach the newer generations of learners what those lines are, but also there is so much that they can teach us as well about wellness and valuing our personal relationships.
That's true. You know, medicine's interesting, and it's probably like some other things, but because it's the only thing that involves directly someone else's health. And medicine is the best example of the fine line between short-term stress and long-term stress, right? So I think what you're talking about meeting halfway is it's not good to be unhealthy all the time. It's not good to not sleep multiple nights in a row. It's not good to, you know, have abuse of recreational drugs or alcohol like physicians in the past and still remains a problem in medicine. It's not good to not have good family relationships and not take care of yourself. And it's not good that the suicide rate amongst medical students and amongst residents is becoming more and more of an issue. And these are real issues. On the other hand, medicine does require in its inherent form some degree of self-sacrifice. And the human being, every person has a different sort of stamina, right? And the key is knowing how much you can push yourself short-term, but it doesn't become a long-term habit. So if each of us does a night overnight because we have to save someone's life, then we do it. And we recover from that. And the question is, how many of those nights can you do? And so it's the balance between the people who... You don't want someone who never wants to do that. Because it's not going to work in the team concept. It's not going to work in your patient concept. Because there's sometimes in life, even in regular life, and if you're not a doctor, that you're going to have to do short-term stressors that life just comes across with you. On the other hand, we don't want to be making the same mistakes we've had in the past, especially as medicine gets more complicated and more stressful with other external factors.
Sure.
So tying to our last role, so you're associate program director now of the residency. One of the mutual hats we now have been incorporating is reviewing residency applications. We're in residency application season. You and I have talked again. It's so challenging to separate out. We're very fortunate in ophthalmology where we have great, great people who are motivated and interested. The amount of research people are producing going to the rest of the applications. I mean, we always joke, but seriously, I don't think I match, maybe not at all, but definitely not in a program like this. You were not matched. You were picked up on the phone. So maybe someone still picks up the phone and calls
even match.
You.
So yeah. It's a different story for me.
So, but the point is like the game has changed and it continues to change. And it's very, very difficult to kind of make decisions about these sort of things. So if you mentor residency applicants, there are residency applicants who may be listening to this now or in the future, what sort of advice do you give them? And then what sort of things do you really value when you look at someone's application? And I can comment a little bit on me too, but I'm interested in what you say.
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, it's understood that the application process for ophthalmology is extraordinarily competitive and that everyone has in their mind a formula of, as the applicant, of what they think should be a star applicant, what will be predictive of being very successful. And of course, it's natural that one would assume that it's good grades, it's good step one and step two CK scores, it's great clinical references and letters of recommendation. The third year performance is paramount for many ophthalmology residency programs. And then you look for all the extras, the people who actually have published quite a bit, the people who've been involved in community service and a lot of extracurricular activities or advocacy groups. I think that some of the things that I look for are a little bit different than what everyone else looks for. I look for signs of someone having a really good heart, someone who's compassionate, someone who the person standing next to them in the class is going to say, this is the person that I want to be my doctor. And so,
and we have the luxury of, luckily, of choice, where a lot of people check all those boxes you talked about before. So we're able to really focus on this sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it's harder to pick up on some of those softer signs that are more on the emotional side, but indicative, I think, of what is critical to being a successful physician who is going to be loved by their patients. And so you try to figure out what those subtle signs are through some of the nuances in their application. Maybe their letters of recommendation, although they're uniformly glowing. But of course, their clerkship narratives can be quite helpful. Sometimes they can have, they could have received some awards. Maybe, I don't know if I put as much heart in standard awards like Gold Humanism, Honor Society, but that's something that they're elected into by their peers. And so to me, that has some value too. And I think your peers are the best gauge of how good of a physician or how compassionate of a physician you will be. Some other things that I really like to look for is consistency. I like to look for someone who's actually not involved in a lot of things just superficially. I like to see someone who's involved in something and sticks to it and is dedicated to it and does it really well.
They really care about it then.
They care about it. They're involved in this extracurricular activity and they've taken it in, and created it and made it into something amazing. I think that the same can be said for research. I think we can, we've both seen lots of applications that have been, I would call them, quote, fluffed, where they have a lot of projects in progress, but nothing finished. And I think we like to see that, we'd rather see someone who's taken something from start to finish and have it manifest in the form of a publication as compared to just 10 different things that never really amounted to a final product. Yeah. So those things are important. And I also don't know that I pay too much heart to grades, but it doesn't hurt if you can see that this individual has always been excelling in school throughout their, you know, throughout their careers. Then there's the other category of student, which I would call the adversity student, the student who maybe struggled early on in their career and had some sort of aha moment where they turned things around and really made their story very compelling to show that they have grit and resilience and perseverance. And to me, that is equally important to being a successful physician. So if there is a compelling story, I really love to hear it. And I think, you know, in the application, we look for that in personal statements. Yeah.
There's just some great points you just said. And just to follow up on those thoughts, I compare what I thought when I was an applicant to what I know now, having now read, we've had 150 of these applications each the last 2 years, and now reading them again when interviewing this last week. First thing is, I always thought that empty space would look bad. So the SF Match gives you a certain amount of space, and empty space would look bad. And I actually would say if you have something powerful to say, or a research project to say that you're really proud of, that's a really impactful thing, it actually sometimes is better to have less there. Because it's hard sometimes when you're reading this many applications. It all blends together, and we have multiple people interviewing. And if you really, I would rather, like you say, see three lines for the research that are all impactful, then the whole thing's just a jumble of words, and you don't really sure what is what, because it's all blended together. As you said, letters, recommendations are glowing. Grades are important, but I think recency is important. Like you said, clinical grades are super important, because they generally don't always, depending on your grading system, but they show, especially rotation, there's some consistency, they show some degree of ability that someone's observing you, and they think that you have the potential, or you're already showing signs you're going to be a good clinician. And then, you know, if someone has struggled at some point, and there's reasons for it, we like to see that. I just think also, so I was asked this question by applicants multiple times, say, what do you look for in an applicant? And I'm like, oh, I can only speak for myself. But this is after we've done all the screening, like in person, what do we really want? And I think if, assuming someone is capable, which we think all these people are, it's ethicality, it's compassion, and it's that grit you talked about, that willingness to work hard, even when doesn't win you any accolades or awards. And that's the consistency part you talked about. You're going to be a doctor for 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40 years. No matter how you map your career, you're a doctor. And you're going to go day in and day out, and you're going to take care of people. Yeah, patients may bring you gifts from time to time. Maybe you win if you're good at your job. Maybe you win at some sort of accolade at some point. There are no awards for being a good doctor, generally. You just do it because that's what you like to do, and that's what you want to be. And so that consistency, this is a tortoise, not a hare. Every day you go to work, you're not getting a pat on the back when you're an attending saying, oh, you did a great job today. You just do it because you like to do it. And if you're not doing it, or if you don't believe that, then maybe it's not the right field for you, or it's not good. You have to kind of look, do a little self-examination. But those are all really great points. And, you know, we talked, it's very, very difficult to sort people out. But it's nice to see that. And so I'm going to let you go in a minute. Any parting piece of advice? We have, again, people who range. We have retina specialists who are fully trained out there. You're not a retinal surgeon, but you are in another subspecialty. We have residents, we have fellows, and we have medical students who listen. Any sort of parting advice about education, about mentorship, anything else? Because these people are going to either, they are learning from somebody or they are teaching somebody a lot of the time.
Well, all right. I have advice for all groups. One is always just try your best. Always be your best. And you just can't have any regrets once you know that you've tried your best at what you've been working at. Whether it's at the level of a medical student and you're trying to get an ophthalmology residency, or whether you're an ophthalmology resident trying to become a fellow, or whether you're a fellow or faculty trying to get a job. And you can never be disappointed in yourself once you've tried your best. Other pieces of advice are that you might be able to have a chart in which you can identify exactly where you're going to end up and what you're going to do with your life, but really, you never know where you're going to end up.
Who's going to call your phone?
You never know who's going to call your phone. Serendipity is really one of those things that you have to take advantage of and think that there must be a higher reason for why things are happening. And I think that that's been true for me in every kind of avenue of my life, whether it was my prelim that turned into a residency, or whether it's my ophthalmology residency that turned into a serendipitous oculoplastics fellowship, or whether it's my career path where I was really interested in resident education and then also got heavily involved in medical student education. I mean, medical student education and student affairs was never on my radar. And so opportunities are going to land in your lap and you have to run with them. And I think that's where the excitement happens. You know, I've always seen this diagram of a Venn diagram of a couple of circles, and you see, like, you know, this circle being your comfort zone, and then you see this other circle that's out of the circle, and it says where the magic happens. Mm-hmm. And so I really think it's always great to try to get yourself out of your comfort zone, because that's when all the really cool stuff happens. And I've been really fortunate to be able to experience that.
Your first podcast, you went outside your comfort zone. You did a great job.
Oh, thank you. It was really fun, and it was an honor to be here. I hope I didn't bore the retina crew that's watching this or
that's
listening
okay.
to
they
this.
They know I like talking about education, so this is perfect.
Okay, excellent.
Chris, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jay. Have a good one.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. We have 208 episodes on that website, including this one. You can also find them sorted by category and search for old episodes if you ever want to listen to them. They're downloadable, so you can put them on your mobile device or on your computer. You can find us in various places. You can get new episode updates by subscribing to our email list server versus via the website. You can also find us at Facebook and Twitter, where we post the latest episodes. And our Twitter handle, @RetinaPodcast, is a good way to contact us, or by messaging us directly on the website, or emailing at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is great. We love people who post reviews in the Apple Store and Android Store on your mobile devices. You can also email us directly with any episode ideas or thoughts on past or future episodes. Thank you again to Dr. Chris Alaviad for sitting down. I love doing these sit-down interviews. Most of our interviews are done over the phone, but it's really nice to do these in-person interviews when we can, and I really enjoy sitting down with them. Drs. Louis Kai, Dr. Michael Nakasa, and Dr. Angela Chang are responsible for the production and social media for this and all other episodes. Thank you to them. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.